On this episode of The Flatus Show, number 58, the Ottoman Empire, the British Mandate for Palestine, Zionism, olive trees, voice comments, this and more. The Flatus Show, starring Kenty and Jose. Welcome to the Flatus Show. Tab for my diet.
Come on, Jose.
You recording?
Yeah, I'm recording.
Oh, you haven't done your show yet?
No, I'm doing the beginning. Oh. Are you taking Jose?
Yeah.
Well, that was John. that's what he gets. A tab for my diet. You see, I have a life outside of podcasting. Welcome to the Flatus Show. You can reach me at kenty@theflatusshow.com or alternatively 206-339-JOSE and leave me a voice comment. Either is welcome. You can also visit my webpage at www.theflatusshow.com and click on the link to the blog, and you can leave comments on there. See what's going on. So, I've been working on this show for a few weeks. A couple weeks ago, on the podcast I did with Big C, called What I Believe Podcast, we were talking about Israel and Lebanon. And I thought to myself, we probably wouldn't have had any of these problems if Israel was never created, which I am not so sure. But I wanted to know how Israel came to be created. And so I did some research. And I read on Wikipedia, and I should say, I looked up on Wikipedia the topics. And I also have a book by A.V. Shlaim, S-H-A-L-I-M, called The Iron Wall, Israel and the Arab World. And I read the beginning of that about the foundations of Israel. But I didn't get in. It's a big book. I mean, it's, I don't know, 600 pages. But I want to read it because it's fascinating. So that's what today's show is about. From last week, my interview with Zilafag, I received several voice comments and emails. It was just really amazing. So I'm going to play those shortly and make comments on them. I just wanted to say something about talking about Judaism and Jews. It sort of makes me uncomfortable. So, you know, Jew is not a dirty word, first off. So let me go on there. Just because I'm talking about Israel and Jews and thinking that possibly that the state of Israel should not have been created does not mean I'm anti-Semitic. It just means the reasons being I'll give you. I mean in the thing, and I'm not even sure if I state it. I'm not even sure what I believe about it. I mean at this point, I was born in '64. Israel was already a country at that point. So you know what, Taffy. Just let it be a country. You know, I wasn't here beforehand to cause all these problems. But it goes back to, you know, 1840. I mean, and some would argue it goes back even further, but I'm not so sure about that. But during my research, I have discovered that there are things missing, like the who, the what, you know, how. Like, for example, who purchased all this land in Palestine, and how much was it, and where'd the money come from? Another thing is, you would think people would read the lease when they bought land. I don't know. There's some other. It's just fascinating. I mean, all these different things that are going on. And in today's world, I mean, I think it's just blown out of proportion, and I don't understand. Well, I understand that this rise of I don't know what the right word is. This rise of what seems to be virulent, warlike Muslim people. And Islam is apparently a peaceful religion. And the Muslims I've met are peaceful. So it might have to do more do... It might have more to do with the Arab personality. Because even though most Arabs are... I mean, they're Arab Christians, but, you know, the majority of Arabs are Muslim, I imagine. And I don't have no facts to back me up on that. That's something that just seems to be right to say. So I should look that up to verify it. But I think they're probably mostly Arab Muslims. Because there's Muslims all over the world. I mean, there's, like, you know, from India there's Muslims, and American Muslims, and Ethiopian Muslims, and we're all over. You know, English Muslims. And they're not all... you know, gung-ho on, you know, fighting the end of the world or whatever. But there seems to be this trend. And so, I don't know. Get over yourself is what I have to say. But anyway, I'm going to go now onto the audio comments, and then we'll start the show. But anyway, I just wanted to say that. I'm not anti-Semitic. Here's a audio comment from Big C, my co-host on What I Believe podcast.
Hey, Ken. Of course, you can use us on the show. This is Big C from the Pulling My Pod podcast, and also Kenty's beloved co-host for What I Believe podcast. And brother, man, I had a laugh out loud. I had a good old belly laugh when you're talking about the people you met and your friends, and you listened to me, which I'm honored. I was like, that's cool. And you said I was an evangelical kind of guy. And I know you mean that very well, and I take that as a compliment. But it's very funny to me, because basically the church is out and out fucking rejected me, man. I guess I can say that word on the Flint show, but it just made me laugh. I don't think I've ever been called evangelical in my life, so that was quite different, dude. I had to call you. Catch you later. Catch you this week on the What I Believe podcast. Later.
Thank you, Big C. I have a few comments to make from your audio comment. Here's a song for you. When it's time to change, you've got to rearrange. Of course, you might get that reference. Peter? No, I meant Big C. Anyway, the evangelical kind of guy. You know why I say that. We talked about that, and I mean that in the best possible way. And I'm sorry to hear that the church rejected you, because, I mean, you know, that's what the church is really meant to do, right, is to reject people. And, of course, you know, this homosexual, liberal, gay guy, I already said that, homosexual, liberal guy from Massachusetts, the state of sin, where we allow gay marriage and all sorts of things, will, allow you to, you know, will accept you. And not reject you. In fact, you said to use the word reject. We don't use the word reject on the Flatus show because we're inclusive. Of course, we're not going to include, everybody, because, you know, you have to have, we're inclusive of people who are, are good people, are smart and productive and loving. How's that? Probably there's more. But, you know, we don't want anybody who's a hate-filled heart. But we'll love them anyway, because that's what Jesus taught us to do. In fact, I was thinking of changing the name of the Flatus show to The Bosom of Jesus, because I accept, you know, I'm accepting and loving. So anyway, thank you, Big C. Here's an audio comment from Joji from the Pepe Podcast.
Hey, Ken. This is Joji from Pepe Podcast. I wanted to say I just heard... your two-part interview with Zillafag, and I thought it was very, very good. I really enjoyed it. I really liked the way you kept going, vit, 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 or whatever noise. I don't even know how you were doing that. If you were making the noise, or if you had a special sound clip that was doing that, it was wonderful. I've never heard anyone do that, where they actually have the show notes, their audio show notes. You know, or like audio footnotes. I really liked that. It was very nice. By the way, did you know I left some comments on your website when you did the videos where you were eating bugs and trying to force, I'm assuming your nephew and nieces or some, maybe your neighbor's children to eat bugs. And I wanted to leave a, in fact, I left a post, but it looks like it didn't come up on your site. So I'm not sure if you actually got those posts or not, but I am actively listening. It was also, back to the interview with Zilafec, I didn't know he was dissed so badly by Reagan Fox. Now, that's interesting. I had stopped listening to Fox and the City for a few weeks, so maybe it was during that period of time. But anyway, just getting your points of view, the two viewers, both you and Zilafec's point of view, were very good. By the way, I do agree with you about Q Potter, although I still have been putting my making announcements about my most recent podcast. I don't think it gets much attention for the podcast anymore. And the site itself seems to be kind of, it's just for people to post what new shows. It doesn't seem to be much communication going on other than that. I've thought about not posting, posting any new info. Oh my God, this is just going on too long. Anyway, I really liked what you had to say about Q Potter. Great interview. Yes, you can use this on your podcast. And, if you're willing to divulge your secret about how you want the vit, that would be really appreciated. Thank you, Ken. Keep podcasting. Bye-bye.
Joe G., thank you for that comment. I did not receive your comment on the blog. Did not show up. So, for whatever reason. They are my niece and nephews. My nieces and nephew, I should say. Actually, through gay marriage, they're my niece and nephews. My nieces and nephew. Though I do have another nephew for my sister. My sister has a child, and she's going to have another child. So, I haven't forced that side of my family to eat crickets yet. So, next time they come up, I'll have to do that. Zilafec interview. I want to give a special thanks to Zilafec because I have had more audio comments and comments in general than any other show I've put up. Q Potter, we all know about Q Potter. Though I'm going to actually talk about Q Potter some more in a later show, more depth about Q Potter, what I think of it, how it has changed. And, of course, I'll need to spend more time on Q Potter to do that. And actually, and it might be at the same time when I reevaluate that Adam Curry show where he ripped Madge Weinstein a new asshole. Or vagina, or whatever. Another hole. Because I've been listening to it. And there are things specifically I'd like to address, which I was too angry to think about before. I know it might be beating a dead horse, but I just need to get it out of my system and get on with podcasting. Okay. Now, for the audio footnote sound, voot, 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 I will teach my listeners how to do this themselves. Okay. Okay, I need you to sit down, and if you're driving, you can't do this. Okay, so if you're in a room, sit down and relax. Close your eyes. Breathe deep. And imagine that you're on a submarine. A Russian submarine. And you're a Russian sailor. And you're walking through the narrow hallway. And you see the different lights. And it's very close. And you can smell all the other sailors. And you're walking through, okay? Now just breathe deep and you're in the submarine, okay? Okay. Now, at this moment, you're a sailor, but you're going to transmutate into an alarm system on the subway, okay? Now, from the point of view, you're on a wall in the subway, I said? Submarine. Submarine. It could be a Russian subway, too. But we're talking about the submarine, okay? Okay, go back into your trance. Okay, go back into your trance. Okay, so you're now a sounding device on the wall. Okay, just pretend, breathe. You're the sound device. Okay, now a torpedo just hit the ship. Okay? And what are you going to do? Voot, 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 voot! You're going to make a sound to alert the sailors to their doom. So that's how you make the sound. You have to pretend that you're a, whatever, some sort of sounding device that sounds off when there's an emergency on a submarine, a Russian submarine. Okay? So there you go. Here's our third comment, and it's a little bit more than a comment. It's actually, it's Ninja from Hot Fossils and Rebel Matters, and she performs a song. So I'll let her introduce it, and then after that, we'll go right into the show.
Hi, it's Ninja here from the Hot Fossils and Rebel Matters show. And this one's for you, Kenty, because I know you play the recorder, and well, it's for all my gay brothers, actually. That was played on my tenor recorder, and I hope you enjoyed it.
Voot, voot, voot! Okay, actually, Ninja emailed me, actually I asked her about the recorder, and here's the email, what she says about it. It's a Serenader brand. I'm not sure if they're even made anymore. I don't actually know what kind of tenor recorder it is, but it has a key. I know there are Renaissance recorders and Baroque recorders and many other kinds. I am not even sure what kind of wood it is made of. I'd have to see if I can find the original information about it. I do have some soprano recorders as well. I don't play them off very often myself either, in fact. Just don't have the time anymore. But, of course, your musical interludes inspired me. Well, thank you, Ninja. I'll tell you, though, I'm almost certain that what you have is a Baroque recorder, because Renaissance recorders are they have different fingerings. So the common fingerings we know are the Baroque. And since it's a tenor recorder, also I can tell from the sound of the recorder is Renaissance recorders are very, very loud, and yours sounds more like what the more modern recorder would sound like. Enough of that, and on with the show. Voot, voot, voot! The Ottoman Empire. Now, the Ottoman Empire existed from 1299 to 1923. That is, let's see here, 624 years. 624 years. Its height of power is in the 16th and 17th centuries, and its territory included Anatolia, the Middle East, parts of North Africa, and much of southeastern Europe to the Caucasus. At its largest, it was 19.9 million square kilometers. And in 1902, which was the point of its smallest area was it went down to 6.3 million square kilometers. Now empires rise and empires fall. We have the Roman Empire and the Egyptian dynasties. And it just happens. The Greek Empire. The Ottoman Empire, though. Now, as I said, it's time that was greatest in power was in the 16th and 17th centuries. In fact, they had tried to take over Austria. They laid siege to Vienna in 1529 and again in 1683. And this kind of, I guess the consciousness, right, of this kind of takeover even appears in, you know, the culture, in Viennese culture. I think Mozart was from Vienna. Yeah, he wasn't German. Yeah, he wrote an opera called Der the Something of Seraglio. Anyway, what it is, it's these Europeans who are sort of kidnapped by the Sultan. And in Corigliano's opera, The Ghosts of Versailles, that shows up again. So they were a force to be reckoned with, and they were Muslim, and they had great power. They weren't Arabs, okay? That's a whole nother ball of wax. Now, just to put this in perspective, Islam started, I think, around 600 AD, and roughly around the same time that the Arthurian legends were supposed to have happened, okay? So let's put it in perspective. You think of Arthurian legends as being maybe earlier or later, but no, it's contemporary with the starting of Islam. Okay, so this dominion, the Ottoman Empire, again, I said, tried to conquer Europe and conquer the Habsburg domain, which is in Austria. And during this time, okay, ended up that the Ottoman Empire was like Janus. It looked in two directions. It looked to the west as well as the east. And it was an integral part of the balance of power between the east and the west. That was the middle ground. That was the place where one walked through the looking glass, you know, or went down the rabbit hole. So if you're coming from the west into the east, you go through the Ottoman Empire, and then you're on the other side. Sort of like walking through the Narnia wardrobe. Now, that didn't last because, as we see, it was dissolved in World War I. The Ottomans, I guess, had sided with the Germans. And this is where we come in with the Arabs. The fall of the Ottoman Empire was partly help. It was partly, the British were fighting the Turks, okay? And I think this is World War I, okay? I guess this is during World War I, so we're talking 1916. So the British were fighting them to help the British fight the Ottoman Empire, they employed the Arabs. And who went in there and helped, you know, rally the Arabs was T.E. Lawrence, Lawrence of Arabia. So we can see the movie Lawrence of Arabia and see what was going on at that time. So after the war, the Ottoman Empire was split up, so to speak. It was dissolved, and it was, you know, the spoils went to the winners of the game. I want to sing an ABBA song right now, but I can't think of it. So, but it really is not the spoils of the war. They didn't own the land. Okay, so the Ottoman Empire is dissolved, and the area which is known as Palestine in the Middle East was what was given to the British to take control over. It was considered an international zone, but the British took control of it. And it included modern-day Israel, Lebanon, I believe, the Gaza Strip, West Bank, Golan Heights, Jordan. And so that's where we're at. So it's the end of the Ottoman Empire, and we have the this area. They've called the Palestine Mandate, I think it is. Mandate for Palestine. British Mandate for Palestine, which the League of Nations set aside.
Das Wandern ist des Jüllers Lust, das Wandern. Das Wandern ist des Jüllers Lust, das Wandern. Das muss ein schlechter Müller sein, dem niemals fiel das Wandern ein, das Wandern, das Wandern, das Wandern, das Wandern.
Palestine. Palestine is essentially the region between the Mediterranean Sea and the banks of the Jordan River with various adjoining lands. It has been described by the ancient Egyptians, who called that area Retinue. And, of course, in the Old Testament Bible, it's been referred to as the land of Canaan. That's just two places that that historically has been recorded in literature. The Israelite period was part of the Iron Age, and that was a united monarchy, and it was reigned from Jerusalem, and it was an area approximating modern Israel with the Palestinian territories, but extending further westward and northward to cover much more for the land of Israel. Now, the word Palestine comes from the word Philistine, which was a non-Semitic ethnic group that inhabited what is essentially the Gaza Strip. Now, the Philistines seem to have disappeared as a distinct ethnic group by the time of the Assyrian period. Let's see here. So you have, this is the area up to 6673, when the Romans, that was the first Jewish-Roman war, and Rome took over that area. Now, is that 6673 BC? It must be. It doesn't say BC. It must be BC, 66 BC, during the Persian period. Here, I'm still recording and reading as I go along. I should have made better notes. I thought I had better notes. Let me pause here. Back. Okay, the Jewish-Roman War was indeed 6673 AD. It was the Great Revolt, because I know that Rome was in the Promised Land, or in Palestine, much earlier. They were there during the time of Jesus' death, which is 33 AD, and they were there before that for a while. So they were in, the Romans ruled that area. But the Jewish-Roman War refers to the revolt, and that is when the what was the big thing that happened there? They sacked Jerusalem and destroyed the Second Temple, leaving only the Western Wall, which is the Wailing Wall. In 135 AD, another fall of a Jewish revolt, led by Bar Kokhba, happened, and that's when Hadrian expelled all the Jews from Judea, leaving large Jewish populations in Samaria. So So there we have like another diaspora, because the Jews were revolting against the Romans, and the Romans won. So the next people to rule the Palestine area was the Byzantine, which is the Eastern Roman Empire period, which is 390 AD. This is when it's still the Roman, but they aren't in Rome anymore. The headquarters have now moved to Byzantine, which I think is Constantinople, which is part of Turkey. So I wonder when Byzantine became, was taken over and became like a Muslim center. So in 390, Palestine was ruled from by the Byzantines until 635, when the Arabs conquered the area. And so the Arabs took over the Palestine area. And then we have the Crusading period. There's another area called Mamluk period, which I really don't know too much about. And then we have the Ottoman Empire in 1516 is when the Ottoman Empire took over the area, which is known as the Palestine. And let's see here. Pause here. So the Ottoman Empire ruled the area, and there was a little skirmish in the early part of the 19th century, but back by 1840, that area was ruled again by the Ottomans. Now, 1840 is an important date because in 1840, okay, we have the British, and this is where the British interest in Zionism starts. And it's because of the British Empire's South Asian enterprises that were concurrent with the Great Game, which I don't know what that is, and I'm sorry I mentioned it, but I'm reading it out of Wikipedia, wikipedia.org. All this information comes from Wikipedia for all your information needs. If you're looking to do a podcast or a book report or some sort of research you need to do, look at a Wikipedia first. Wikipedia. Okay, and they were planning a Suez Canal at that time. Okay, so as early as 1840, Lord Palmerston, later to become Prime Minister, wrote, "There exists at the present time among the Jews dispersed over Europe a strong notion that the time is approaching when their nation is to return to Palestine. It would be of manifest importance to the Sultan to encourage the Jews to return and settle in Palestine, because the wealth that they would bring with them would increase the resources of the Sultan's dominions, and the Jewish people, if returning under the sanction and protection at the invitation of the Sultan, would be a check upon any future evil designs of Egypt or its neighbors. I wish to instruct Your Excellency strongly to recommend to the Turkish government to hold out every just encouragement to the Jews of Europe to return to Palestine." How interesting, you know, as early as 1840. Now, other writing shows that, you know, that was 1840, okay. We find out that the Ottoman Sultan discouraged all large-scale immigration to Palestine. Replying to a request by Rabbi Joseph Nantonek for permission to settle Jews in 1876, that almost all lands in Palestine were occupied and that the autonomy sought by Nantonek was incompatible with the administrative principles of the state. So, and decrees against mass settlement were issued by the Ottoman government in 1884, 1887, and 1888. Significant numbers of Jews began making aliyah to the Holy Land in 1882 to build collective farms and eventually establish the city of Tel Aviv in 1909. So we have people, actually Jewish people from Europe, going to Palestine as early as 1882. That's the first one. And they're building cities. So by 1882, what's that? 17 years, they have a city named Tel Aviv. Now, we find out also that there's some interesting – you'll find this on Wikipedia and throughout the net – interesting facts about population growth. Who was there? The population at the beginning of the 20th century in that area was about 500,000 people, most of which were Muslims, okay? And there were about 60,000 Jews. And by the end of World War I, actually the number of Jews in Palestine declined to 55,000, according to this note. So we're here in Palestine. It's 1882. It's as early as 1840. Lord Palmerston even said to the Sultan, hey, why don't you just let the Jews have, you know, for whatever reason. I guess it was talked about, I mean, because he seemed to think that that was a discussion, that was a topic, as early as 1840 to create this nation or a homeland. Because as you'll find out later is that when these, I guess, when these things came about to these meetings to have a home for the Jews, it was a home for the Jews, not a homeland, a country. So there's sort of, it's not clear whether there was to be some area where Jewish people could go to claim as a home, but not necessarily govern as a political entity. Like, they would have political rights if you live in an area. I mean, if all the Jews, let's say you have every Jewish person in the world move to Indiana or whatever, you know, or some small Rhode Island, let's say. I don't know if they all, everybody could fit in Rhode Island. I mean, they would have some sort of, you know, voice to vote, right? So, and it's interesting because in this late 18th century, in the late 19th century, so I'm getting into Zionism now, so maybe I'll just stop this part. So Palestine. So after the Ottoman rule ended in 1923, the area known as the British Mandate of Palestine was that area was given to Britain to control. So that's it for Palestine.
Let the darkest hour come just before the dawn. Soon the melancholy hum of nighttime will be gone. Shadows creeping round the world, leaving doubt and fear. Daylight soon will be unfurled. Look, the morning's here. Wake with the buttercup. Come on, get up. Here comes the sun. Open your sleepy eyes. Look at the flaming skies. Here comes the sun. Turn your back on the night. Morning's cheerful and bright. Not a shadow in your way. This day is your day. Wake with the singing birds, shout out those lucky words. Here comes the sun. Lovers are hand in hand. This is the promised land. Daydreams are spun. Laugh, your sorrow is over, and half the battle is won. Life's no gloomy race. Light your happy face. Here comes the sun.
The British Mandate for Palestine. So, the British had control of Palestine, which I've described, which includes modern-day Israel, the Gaza Strip, Jordan, and it was all part of the Balfour Declaration from the Versailles Peace Conference the League of Nations had in 1919. And now, so you had the Balfour Declaration, which essentially during World War I, British had made two promises regarding this territory in the Middle East. One, they promised the local Arabs through Lawrence of Arabia, that's T.E. Lawrence, independence for a united Arab country covering most of the Arab Middle East in exchange for their supporting the British, because as I said, the Arabs were essential in helping Britain fight the Ottoman Empire to help dissolve it and, you know, helping fight the Germans. And again, we'll see that the Arabs helped the Germans during World War II. Okay. And they also made a promise to create and foster a Jewish national home as laid out in the Balfour Declaration of 1917. Now, how are you going to do these two things? Right? They got themselves in a pickle. And I think the British also got themselves in a pickle when they left India and they created Pakistan for the Muslims. And I think it's because the British were siding with the Muslims at this time. They had done so much for them, helping them, you know, win the different wars, you know, World War I and actually win World War II as well. So, okay, so that's that. Now, there's a portion of the Balfour Declaration, which I'm going to read. His Majesty's government view with favor the establishment in Palestine of a national home for the Jewish people and will use their best endeavors to facilitate the achievement of this object, it being clearly understood that nothing shall be done which may prejudice the civil and religious rights of existing non-Jewish communities in Palestine or the rights and political status enjoyed by Jews in any other country. Syria, by the way, was the French mandate, had the French mandate of Syria in that area. So this is where we're at. Up to 1923, the Ottoman Empire, we had actually Jews emigrating to Palestine area. And during the British mandate period, afterwards, the British said, okay, we're going to have a Jewish homeland, while also telling the Arabs there's going to be an Arab homeland or whatever, an Arab country. Just to be, you know, to be clear about this, there were about, in the 20s, by the 1920s, there were about 100,000 Jewish immigrants to enter Palestine, and there were 6,000 non-Jewish immigrants. And the total population, I think, was about 750,000, most of it being Arab or Muslim. Now, what's interesting about this is that what has been going on for a while is the purchase of land in Palestine by what is called the Jewish Agency. It actually says here Jewish agencies, which I'm not really sure what that means. And they purchased land from absentee landlords. Let's see. Let me actually read it from Wikipedia because it explains it. First of all, as the Jewish people started coming into Palestine, this area, there was violent protest against them from the Arabs because they're like, hey, all these people are moving in and taking over our land. But there's a reason why they were upset. And this is it. In some cases, land purchases by the Jewish agencies from absentee landlords led to the eviction of the Palestinian Arab tenants, who were replaced by the Jews of the kibbutzim. The Arabic speakers before World War I had the status of peasants, fellahin, and did not own their own land, although they might own the trees that grew on that land. Because most of these Jews were familiar with the European tradition of land ownership, they did not realize that they were purchasing only the land, not the trees that grew on that land. This was often a source of misunderstanding and conflict. The olive tree in particular is particularly important as it can remain productive for more than 1,000 years. So you see, kids, the Jewish agencies were buying up land, and that's all they were really buying. They had no right to tear down the trees or whatever they were doing. I don't know what they were doing. But the point is that somebody owned that land, was selling it to somebody, regardless of whether it was Jews, Christians, Irish, Chinese, or whatever. Somebody, an Arab, owned that land, I'm assuming, sold it to the Jews, had no compunction. Compunction is probably too strong of a word. They didn't care. They said, okay, here's the land. Go ahead, buy it. But then you have the peasants, okay? These are people who are not landowners, but that was a different culture, you know? They worked the land. They were Bedouins and stuff like that, you know? So these people come in. Okay, we bought this land. Let's get going. Get the hoe moving. Come on. And, of course, that's going to create some sort of, you know, problem, don't you think? I mean, that's where I think all this problem is. It's the damn lease. You should have read the lease. Of course, they're buying it, so. But they, you know, it's like, I don't understand. You know, these are crazy things. I mean, I think it even happens today. I don't think people read the lease. Of course, the world is a lot different now. But I don't know. Is it really? I mean, what do you think? Do you think it's culture? How much culturally different do you think it is in the Middle East than it is in the West? Maybe that's why the, you know, Al-Qaeda hates the West, you know, because of our. We just have no idea of what it's like to have to live in an Arab culture. And I guess supporting the West has. But the thing I don't understand is, okay, we've supported Israel, right? I mean, it's been shown that the United States has supported Israel. But it all started from the British. So why didn't the Muslims attack the British long ago? It was the British who did this. You know, they're the ones promising everything. It was back in 1840. America was, you know, didn't even have Hawaii yet. Probably in many states at that point. But, you know, I mean, why are they coming after America? You know, we're supporting Israel because, you know what, kids? Let's face it. Israel's here to stay. Let's help you out. It is a democracy. There's a lot of great things about Israel, okay? But the very beginning of Israel, I mean, is like mired in all these problems and all this strife, you know? Is it really necessary? And I'm really wondering, you know, I feel like singing John Lennon's song, let's give peace a chance. All we are asking is give peace a chance. But, you know, I don't think that's going to happen. But let's, I mean, what would happen if, you know, Iran and all these countries, I mean, in the Six-Day War, I mean, the Israelis, like, beat up everybody. And I just saw Munich, too. And the Mossad, I mean, according to that movie, is this evil CIA. Not that, you know, I think all Secret Service are probably evil, but, I mean, what they did, you know, to take out the September Black September group. So, okay, another thing is that, you know, of course, you know, you have the Jews moving into Palestine, okay? You have the Jews from Europe moving into Palestine, okay? So, by a certain point, there's too many, and I'm putting quotes up, because I'm thinking from the Arab point of view here. And, of course, the Arabs are upset. And they fight, and, you know, and, of course, you know, the Jewish people there have to defend themselves, right? But, I mean, it's not like anybody – whose land is it? I mean, who's the country? I mean, it's like people – I just don't understand that. It's like if you buy up land, it's not – you can't make your own country. It's like, you know, suppose somebody bought up Rockport. Now, it's small enough, right? Somebody rich guy or whatever could buy it and make – hey, I'm going to make it its own country. But I don't think you can do that according to the United States Constitution. But what would you do if this guy had a lot of money and enough – arms, you know, came in and moved arms into Rockport and said, you know what, this little part of paradise is seceding, and so you have this Liechtenstein-like state right there. What are you going to do? You know, I mean, I don't know. But this has happened time and time again through history, and it just so happens that has happened again with Israel. Which I believe they even have every right to defend themselves, but just the whole beginning of it, I just can't wrap my mind around. It just seems like, why are you there? And another thing, okay, early Zionist movement thought, hey, well, why don't we put Zion in Argentina or Uganda? These were all areas which were discussed. Even there was one early American Jew who was thinking about this, and he wanted to create a Jewish area in upstate New York and call it Ararat, based on the mountain that the Noah's Ark was on. You know, in Argentina, it's like, because it's a fertile land. I mean, Argentina is fertile, but you know, what are you going to do with the Argentinians? You know, just tell them, well, we're going to take over the southern part of your country. Now, okay, another thing is, we're talking about a pretty big piece of land, okay, in Israel, okay? The Jewish agencies were buying up this land. Who was supporting this? I mean, that's a lot of money, right? And so I think there's a conspiracy that the Rothschilds family was buying this, and it made me do a little search about billionaires. It's like not a billion billionaires, but there's a billionaires. I mean, families who make $11 billion, it's like DuPont and all sorts of things. Let me see if I can find my billionaire thing. Okay, I can't find the billionaires. Oh, is this it? Hold on. Okay, I found the billionaire thing. Okay, here's the Michelin family, the Mellon family, Porsche family, Bombardier, Rothschild, Brown, Lavazza, you know, who else? Rockefeller, who else is here? I'm trying to find them here. Where are they? Where are the families here? They have a list of them. Okay, hold on. Hold on, Taffy. Okay, here we go. The Beringer family, a lot of them are German. Boreas, I can't remember. Okay, that one's going to go past me because it's in Finnish. Engelhorn, DuPont. So, I mean, there are these all over the world. I don't know. There's maybe 50 of them. Billions. And they start at 1 billion. 1.7 billion. The Walden family in the United Kingdom. Lord Walden. So where did this money come to buy all this land in Israel to begin with? Because, I mean, that's a pretty big, would be a big area. So somebody was buying up the land, you know. And who did they buy it from? That's what I want to know. Who sold the land? And how was the money purchased? Where did the money come from? You know, you follow the money. And of course, I don't know if there's even any way of following the money at this time. What kind of records are there? Do they have leases in the Israeli government saying, you know, we bought this land, this, here, and then, and there? And the Jewish agency, what does that mean? Well, that apparently, according to these Wikipedia entries, the Jewish agency became the government of Israel. But I just want to know who they were, where the money came from, how much they actually spent for it. Did they read the lease? Oh, well.
You've been listening to The Flavor Show. You can reach me at 206-339-JOSE, or you can reach me at kenty@theflatorshow.com. Thank you for listening.